From today's speaker is Professor Charles Chuck Francis of UNL's Department of Agronomy and Horticulture. Chuck was educated at the University of California, Davis and Cornell, and he currently teaches both here on East Campus, that is both here in Lincoln on East Campus, and in Norway. And, you know, one of the genius aspects of the Paul Olson seminar series is that we in this community get a chance that we otherwise might not have to hear people like Chuck Francis right here at home, not having to go to Norway to listen to him. He is an agronomist and plant breeder, and he has conducted research in some 50 countries around the world. He's interested in local food sovereignty as well as global respect and interdependence among cultures. So I am delighted to introduce Chuck Francis. His talk today is called Sustainable Farming and Food Systems in the Great Plains. Chuck.
Thanks for the introduction. It's certainly an honor to be invited to be in this series, having known Paul Olson for years. And I certainly don't know a fraction of his resume, but I know him through the Center for Rural Affairs, the Ag at the Center program, his work with Nebraskans for Peace, and I'm sure the list goes on and on. So it's a real honor to have my name even slightly associated with his. We do have another association, too. I happen to jog or bike by his house every day on the way to East Campus from down on Pioneers Boulevard. And one day I stopped by because I said, I'm sorry, I didn't get back to you and answer your phone call, that I really couldn't attend the Little League game that you told me about. He said, oh, that's another Paul Olson. I was standing by the screen door and looking a little puzzled, and I figured out why. There's at least one more in the community. So the future, and we're talking here about long-term future, and I think it's great to see all these photos around because this kind of sets the context for the Great Plains and neighboring states around Nebraska. And that's what we're really going to go into, is how do we sustain food farming systems in this place, in a place that's very unique in lots of ways, has important resources, great soils in some parts, adequate water in the Ogallala Aquifer. It's going to last for a while. At least we have first shot at it because people down south run out before we do. So it's going to be all about food, environment, and social implications of various types of farming systems. You probably didn't hear too much about that last night if you watched TV at all. Was food mentioned once during the debates? I don't think so. Bob says no.
Food stamps.
Food stamps, thank you. They were, weren't they? And, you know, in the midst of all the furor over who is the greenest coal exploiter and who is going to drill where and all this stuff, just not a whole lot about long-term future. It's all about the next month almost and who's going to get elected and what they have to say to get that to happen, I guess. So we're going to look at a longer time frame. And I'm not sure forever is the best time frame, but something near to that. So we'll talk about food and farming systems, and you have to be on a desert isle somewhere, totally isolated, to not see everything that's in the papers, the other media on the internet about current food challenges and resource challenges. And we've been challenged in this last year here in Nebraska by an exceptionally dry summer, quite low crop yields. Yet it's amazing, thinking spatially, how little effect this had on the price of corn. The price of corn is maybe 6%. I mean, the price is very high, but the reduced production nationwide is only about 6%, which is just astounding. When I was in Norway reading all these things, looking at the maps of the drought, I thought, wow, price is going to go way beyond the $7.50 a bushel that it is now. But not. It's a resilient system. It's spread out spatially, and these are the kinds of things we need to think about as we think locally and also look at ways to work across space. Like I said, things coming across all the time. I push the button until it's green here, right? There we go. Let's see if this changes now. It changed. I didn't even push it. Okay. This just came in this morning from Fred Kirschman, a good friend over at Iowa State. He happens to be an organic farmer in North Dakota, 3,500-acre organic farm. And that sounds like kind of a oxymoron, but that was right. That's the right number of zeros. Cattle, crops, and he has also been for about 6 years director of the Leopold Center at ISU, Iowa State. And he points out several things that are really important for us to think about to set the context. These natural resources are in a state of decline because we're using them up. We have to find other sources or use the ones we have much more efficiently, particularly fossil energy. Phosphate, which is something in scarce supply that occurs in a few concentrated places around the globe, and we mine that, spread it out thinly over our farms and fields. Crops use it. Much of it is bound with the soil clay particles. Some runs off with erosion, ends up in the ocean, which is not very recoverable, at least in the short term. Fresh water, we use about 70%, I believe, of the fresh water supply worldwide in agriculture. But we can't compete with other industries. Anyone else can add more value to water than we can in agriculture. Once water is concentrated, whether it's in the Platte River or McConaughey or in any other spot where people have access to it, folks who want this for their city water supply, people who want to do hunting, fishing, and all, they can pay more than we can in agriculture for water because they add a lot of value to that resource. So these are scarce resources that we have to have. And our real advantage in agriculture is the collection over a broad, extensive area of sunlight and rain and snow. Those are our advantages, so we have to exploit those, and we'll get to that and talk about the importance of internal resources. Fred points out in this article, it just came, the increased frequency of severe weather events, and I think that's probably more accurate than talking about warming. Warming is a much more gradual process, but this severity of weather and unpredictability is the thing that we're dealing with. After about two centuries of fairly benign weather and a nice bubble of fossil fuels, that's what our much of our population growth is based on and our current production. Fred goes on to talk about some of the structural issues in agriculture and suggests that the industrial model of ag and even the industrial economy are becoming obsolete. And we'll get into the industrial ag model pretty soon. And he suggests, and I obviously grabbed onto this because I agreed with it, this emerging science of ecology, what we call agroecology, is really coming to the fore as one of the most exciting parts of agriculture research and teaching. Fred goes on to suggest that economies that are based on partnership, cooperation, countries working together, states working together, communities working together, have a much better chance of survival long-term than following our current totally competitive free market model. So in the spirit of the debate, I'm going to make 3 points today. Three possible futures: a Buffalo Commons, an industrial monoculture as we have today, and the third one, ecological systems for the future. And I hope to present a fairly convincing case that the first two won't work, and that provides a foundation for the third. And, of course, the future is going to be some balance among these three, but we'll talk about each of these in turn. But when we talk about sustainability, that's a rather maligned, probably overused term when everyone from Monsanto with sustainable chemical use to Walmart with sustainable supply chains to everyone else, everyone who is either greening or greenwashing their particular activity or business uses the term, it sort of loses its currency. But we do have to define it and use it, and I find it useful, but we have to say, you know, under what conditions? If we have fossil fuels that are inexhaustible, that means we look at sustainability differently. If there's plenty of water, it's different. So under what conditions? Is this a short-term activity or long-term? So time frame is important. And then sustainable for whom? For those who have the resources, for the 1%, for the 10%, or for everyone? Things we look at in agroecology, and ecologists recognize these things, are system boundaries. When we start talking about the boundaries of a farm or a region, how do we define those? How do we consider those as we look at inputs, outputs, exchange of goods and services, and so on? We look at in agroecology production and economics, obviously, because that's what sustainability is based on in the current economic system. But we also look at eco-services, things that are often not paid for or even recognized, we often take for granted. And then people. people are part of the system, and of course agroecosystems are human-designed, human-operated systems. So we have to think about the social viability and equity issues. Then finally, from ecology, can we learn from natural systems about how we can more sustainably design and manage our farming systems? So here are the three. Did I go backwards? I guess I did. So what do we think about as we, you know, look around here and we see a lot of natural ecosystems? Are these just pretty places, wonderful photography? Are they resources to be exploited? Are they places we could possibly put another pivot system? What do we think about? If we're historians, we think back into Native American lore and how these folks first came across Beringia and settled this place along with some of the large mammals that came with them. If we're plant breeders, we think about the plants that were indigenous here, such as maize, squash, sunflower. That's about the end of the list. Most all of our crops came from other places, mostly from Mediterranean and Eurasia. Or if we're more recent historians, we think about most of our ancestors who arrived here and brought their practices and crops from Northern Europe or the Mediterranean and moving from horses to mechanization and on to some of the huge systems we'll see here in a minute. So how we view the landscape really determines what we do with it. It depends a lot on our worldview and other things. I'll get it straight here sooner or later. And when we look at the landscape, what do we see? Do we see this as a future that's good, sustainable, useful for us, for most of us at least? Do we see these vast expanses of soybeans, corn, wheat as what it's going to be like down the road? I was interviewed by a gentleman from KRVN a while ago, and probably makes some of my extension clients unhappy if they hear what I said about irrigation, but he said, what about irrigation on the plains for the future? And I said, yeah, I think we've got a great water resource. I think we'll be using it, but it won't be for corn. It's going to have to be for higher value stuff because people east of here can grow the same corn yields we can without irrigation. So we're not going to compete with them well in the long term. So we look at the landscape. We see the resources. We see what's out there. Down in the lower right there, we see the sand hills where we've tried to farm at least three times unsuccessfully. Back in the 1890s, I believe, and again before the Dust Bowl, and then again due to tax credits and all during the 70s, found out that that wasn't really an appropriate place to plant corn with a lot of inputs because everything blew away. So we used some of the pivots to plant grass back in, and some of them just rotted away. Most of them eventually got hauled off for scrap, I guess. So it's a question of looking at this landscape, looking at unique places in this landscape and thinking about what can most appropriately be produced there sustainably in the long term. And that's a good place to graze cattle. Well, I'll get it together here. So sustainability, I would argue, is shaped by history, by settlement patterns, by the crops and the practices we brought with us. And we can learn from current systems, particularly some of the things that are good and how we can use technology, but also what some of the adverse effects are and how we can improve on those through this ecological approach I'm going to extol pretty soon. In a lot of ways, our future systems will depend on how we see the world, our worldviews. Do we see ourselves as dominators of this environment, this natural resource base, or do we see ourselves as one more species as part of this large, complex ecosystem? And are we going to survive along with a relatively intact agro-ecosystem and natural ecosystem to our benefit and to that of other species? Depends on our assumptions about fossil fuels, water, political system, markets, subsidies, and all the rest. And then I think we can predict a lot of the impacts of the decisions we make. In fact, I think we can even plan the future. That sounds a little weird because the future is kind of hard to predict, but I really like this from a Nobel laureate physiologist back in the 80s, I believe. Trend is not destiny. We can design a future we want, and we can work to make that happen in my opinion. So here are our three futures. Buffalo Commons. And you've heard about this through the visitors we've had from Rutgers University, and we'll talk about them in a minute. The whole idea here is that we turn the plains back to the buffalo. We consolidate land areas. Their first proposal was under federal control, and that wasn't very popular locally. And this is a way to preserve a lot of ecosystem services, preserve an intact ecosystem that is valuable to certainly bison, cattle, other grazers, but it doesn't produce the kind of food or enough food for us in the future. So we'll argue that this is not a good strategy, except for those niches where this is the best system and we can't do other things. Two, to continue with our specialized industrial monoculture system that we see as we drive up and down I-80 is not sustainable, in my opinion, because it depends a lot on fossil fuels, it depends on water and the expensive irrigation systems we have, and other scarce inputs such as phosphorus. So if we can find other alternative systems that are equally productive, that are dependent on local renewable resources on the farm, I think we have a much better chance to make this sustainable. So that leads to the obvious third one, this ecological future that brings crops and animals back together. Depends on other ways than spraying chemicals everywhere and fouling our water supplies and getting this into our food. I think a decentralized ownership pattern, medium to small family farms rather than huge consolidated farms. And then something that's coming to the fore a lot now is this idea of local food sovereignty or control over our food system. And we lose that in a globalized type of system. So here are the conclusions. We'll start with those, and then if you're so inclined, you can go do something else. I think this is what a future system should look like, and increasingly more of our systems, I think, will look this way for all kinds of economic and environmental reasons. It'll be much more diverse than it is now. It produces food for people, not ethanol, and increasingly food that we can consume rather than feed for captured animals we put into confined animal operations. We've mentioned the natural, renewable, local resources. I think the ownership problem we have, this consolidation, is killing our communities. According to an article in Harper's Magazine last July, I believe it was, 6,000 towns have disappeared completely in Kansas alone. I didn't check that out, but that's what the article said. Moving toward more local marketing, doing processing, adding value both on the farm and in the local community, I think has tremendous value to both the farm and to the community. It employs more people, keeps that value right there where the natural resources are, in contrast to the large industrial system where we buy a lot of expensive stuff, that being equipment, pesticides, fertilizers, and then we ship off low-value stuff. We ship off commodities. And increasingly, with larger farm size, most of the money on both those sides of the equation bypass the local farm community, because a large farmer will not necessarily buy a tractor from the local dealer, but go onto the web and buy it from Missouri if it's $10,000 cheaper and you can easily pay the transportation, and then go to your local dealer to try and get repairs and hope that he's forgiving. So we buy the stuff that's expensive, then we ship off raw commodities to let somebody else add value to them. I think we can do better than that. This equity issue is a tough one to deal with, and I don't think we have easy solutions, but the idea of food as a human right is not a new concept. Eleanor Roosevelt pushed this as part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the UN Charter. And it's recently, last 20 years, come to the fore in Scandinavia, particularly in the Brundtland Report, Our Common Future, where she and her UN committee call for food as a human right, to recognize that and to actually implement that. So just a brief pitch for agroecology before we get back into those three systems. It is characterized by sustainability in the production system. Profitability has to be. Otherwise, you don't stay in business. You need to preserve, we need to preserve our resources. As the Brundtland Report says, use our resources without foreclosing on any of the options for future generations to have access to these same resources. Obviously, a livable environment. And then something that's socially viable, does not produce a lot of haves and have-nots. Okay, let's talk about the Buffalo Commons. This is the first model. Pretty obvious what that is. The Native American approach to this was a fairly sustainable one, using the resources there. The paupers are a couple from Rutgers University who came out and coined this term, the Buffalo Commons. The idea was to consolidate a lot of land under a federal model of some sort, and that was met with a lot of opposition here. And I think the paupers really got a bad rap in a lot of ways because all they really did was to come out here to the Midwest and they held up a mirror and said, you know, look at yourselves. Here are the demographics of rural Nebraska, of rural Great Plains communities. And so in good fashion, we didn't think too much about their advice. We shot the messenger and felt good about it and sent them back east. And fortunately, they kept coming back and talking to us, and enough people have been listening and thinking about this as a possibility. What makes this undesirable, of course, is we lose cereal production in the favored areas where soils are good. We don't necessarily need more protein in our diets. We're somewhat overnourished already. But it is happening. There is consolidation. There are bigger ranches all the time. Ted Turner name comes to the fore, of course, and other large nonprofit groups are putting together big ranches. They employ some of our graduates from our department, so that's good. So this will be part of the future, but I hope a small part. A couple of things from Native American philosophy that I like a lot. What we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. We're part of the web of life, part of this complex ecosystem. Attributed to Chief Seattle, who said a lot of good things like this, or if he didn't, he should have said them, I guess. Then the Iroquois thing about seven generations is really good. And in the debates last night, you didn't hear a whole lot of seven-generation thinking. It's more like seven or 14-day thinking toward the election. But we need to provide the incentives for people to think longer ahead rather than think in terms of quick one-liners and cliches and how do you batter down the other guys and not work with them. I've probably said close to enough about industrial monoculture, but let's say a little bit more. When you drive across, you see this. You see corn and soybeans. Some call this a corn-soybean desert in some ways. And it's a very good system to produce a fairly large amount of grain. It's well adapted, does not use the sunlight water through a good part of the year because the crops are only there in the summer. So other systems that, such as pastures, perennial forage crops, do use the land over more of the year. Our production per unit of labor is very high. That's an envy of everyone. The idea that we have the highest crop yields in the world is not totally true. We do have high yields, but there are many other multiple crop systems in tropical areas and more intense systems here in the plains that produce higher yields per unit area. And we are going to continue to increase yields somewhat, but in spite of what you hear from some of the commercial transgenic corn breeding companies, we're not going to increase crop yields, in my opinion, and that of most of our public sector breeders. We are going to, through GMOs, make things more convenient for farmers, which may or may not be a good idea, but it's not going to increase yield potential from what we've seen so far. And there's no reason to change. This is very expensive technology. Makes farming more convenient. Unfortunately, it contributes to consolidation because people can cover more acres with the same amount of time and larger equipment. Where we will see increases, I think, are closing the yield gap between what's genetically possible and where farmers are now. And when you get up to about 90% of that potential, that's about as far as you can go on a large scale because soils differ, farmers differ in their management and all the rest. But it's pretty hard to push yields up much higher than that 90%, according to those who study these things. So we have chances for higher yields. They are not explained by these commercial claims that they're going to triple the genetic potential of yields by the year 2030. One of my friends, a soybean breeder, who's a very, very apt student of these things and uses genetically modified transgenic stuff in his own program, says that the ratio of hype to reality in the seed industry is close to infinity. He likes that. I do too. Going on, the challenges that we see are the scarcity of inputs to keep these systems going. They're very fossil fuel dependent. We're getting up to these yield plateaus. Genetic resistance has come out in fields. I think there are 700 or some species of insects and weeds now that have shown genetic resistance to the BT trait in corn and to Roundup. And it's a no-brainer. Whatever you throw at crops, whether it's continuous tillage or a particular chemistry in sprays or a new genetically modified transgenic crop, they're going to develop resistance to that if you use the same strategy over and over and over. That's a given. So to think that can be somehow changed through transgenics is a myth, I think. We also have a fairly fragile farm economy. If you have irrigation this year, you paid a lot for water and pumping, but you have extremely high crop prices now and pretty good yields this year, so you'll come out pretty well, as you have for the last couple of years. But a lot of this is propped up by subsidies, traditionally. And over a period of time, about half of net income has come from subsidies. Not true in the last 2 or 3 years because of the high crop prices. But uncertainty. I think the ag budget is large, but a large proportion of that is food stamps, the one thing that was mentioned in terms of food in the debates, I guess. Some of the challenges are the size issue, and people say get big or get out. You've heard that for a long time. We had four previous secretaries of agriculture here, 2 weeks ago, I guess, speaking on East Campus, and I didn't go to the transcript or listen to it, but I did read Art Hovey's article, and I trust Art a lot. I didn't see anything very innovative in there. It was mostly business as usual. So I think what's being pushed by these folks who are high up in agriculture, and sorry to say, most of the people in our departments on East Campus are pushing the fine-tuning of this industrial monoculture. As farms get bigger, you have fewer jobs. The jobs that are there are lower wage jobs, and I would maintain that those minimum wage folks driving the tractor don't have the same interest in conservation, the same interest in preserving either the tractor or the land long term, because they're not being paid to do that. And I mentioned that a lot of the money that goes through this monoculture system kind of bypasses, goes straight past the local community, goes to the input dealers, some of whom may be local, some of whom may not, and it goes on to the to industry. So communities don't see a lot of this. They will have, again, in the input side, low-wage jobs running pallets around and driving fertilizer tanks and custom applying anhydrous and things. But those are not the people that are running the farm, making long-term investments, looking at conservation as a big issue. Okay, let's go to my favored option here. This is option three. This is what I think should gradually replace the other two, particularly the high-input monoculture system. I think we need to go back to smaller production units, both smaller ownership units, so more people are involved in ownership and the real benefits that accrue from being a landowner, and smaller fields and systems such as the one you see there on the right with strips that diversify even the field where the crops are grown in 1 year. You can set up a rotation such as this 3-year rotation of corn, soybeans, and oats and just march that series of strips across the field. You can have something growing out there through the year with a winter crop and a couple of summer crops. You can avoid these 20 to 30 ton rains. That's loss of soil per acre when you have a huge rain in May on our lust soils in western Iowa, where it's been measured. the stuff just all runs down because there's nothing to stop it. There's no vegetation, no root structure or anything. So you can do a lot of good things with this kind of in-field diversity. Crop rotations are well known way back to biblical times and before. The benefits of putting on manure, green cover crops, and the kinds of dissimilar crops we put into rotation, such as cereals and legumes, annual crops and perennial crops, to compete with different species of weeds and use intelligent design, if you like, of the system in comparison to pulling a product off the shelf. And that goes for organic farming, too. Organic farmers are very prone to find a magic bullet. Here's something that will do the job because we're kind of accustomed to spraying something and watching the bugs fall off the plants. That's pleasing to us rather than thinking long term. And I have a hard time in extension sometimes because I get a call in June saying, I've got a bunch of weeds in my soybeans. What do I spray or what do I do? And I say, well, okay, how many weeds are out there? How big are they compared to the crop? Then I eventually get to, you know, why do you have weeds out there? What is there in the design of your system that created a bunch of niches to allow those weeds to grow? Farmers don't want to hear that. They want to know how to kill them. Diverse systems spread labor around the year and provide diverse sources of income because these commodity prices do fluctuate. I think we talked a bit already about the renewable resources, maybe enough. The idea of integrating crops and animals back rather than having these separate, put in pens and having to haul all the food feed to them, makes much less sense than having animals on the land grazing pastures, particularly intensive rotational grazing that can increase your productivity of a given piece of land by about 50%. And we have plenty of good data on that, and a lot of progressive farmers are doing that. There are also multiple crop systems where you put a number of crops in the field in a given year, and this is a good way to exploit resources more thoroughly. You have crops with different kinds of root systems, different planting dates. In Taiwan, I've seen systems like the one lower right there that are rice-based, but they may have up to 15 crops in a year in the same field. That means a lot of hand labor, transplanting things in as you take other things out. The idea of adding value locally is really important, I think, because rather than export low-value stuff, we should be adding value to that ourselves. And there's obviously some economies of scale, not only in farming, but in processing, marketing. But we need to look for a balance, again, between what we can do locally, efficiently, and what needs to be done in a more centralized way. Anything we do that markets direct or takes advantage of these kinds of value-adding activities will increase local employment and keep that value in the community. It'll keep the institutions, the schools, things that we're losing today from a lot of our rural communities. So economies of scope, quality economies rather than just economies of scale. Quality of life comes from having a place where you can shop, a school close by. And many of you have rural roots here or have good friends. Rural Nebraska, you know the kind of heartache that goes along with the school being lost, consolidating with a nearby community, and goes far beyond just deciding which mascot to adopt and where the school will be. And diversity can be much more easily attained or reached at lower levels of scale. Information is an interesting resource. In a monoculture industrialized type of system, we've used information to homogenize the cropping environment, to be able to use the same hybrid of corn, soybean variety, use the same inputs over a wide area, as wide as possible, because that simplifies management and allows you to farm on a bigger scale. But you can also use information as a renewable resource that grows with use rather than being expended. And we can look for ways to apply that to contextualizing practices, farming activities, so we do the right thing in the right place. And then information grows by using it, by testing things. The other thing we put a lot of emphasis on in agroecology is the idea of farmer experiences, traditional knowledge, and we put much more value on that than we learned about when I was an undergraduate at Davis. And part of my professional career, it was all based on science. That was the ultimate answer, and the science was always reductionist, not systems. And we looked at one component or two at a time rather than looking at whole systems and their performance. When we talked to farmers and used them as a resource for information, we got a much more holistic look at things because farmers are balancing information resources, observations all the time. When I worked at Rodale for a year, the neighbor John Brubaker farmed about, I think, 300 acres. That was divided into 80-some small fields. And he farmed each of those, designed the rotation for each of those, not on the computer. He had his own hard drive up here, but he knew what went on. And from his observations, he knew what was needed there fertility-wise, what the pests were. He knew with his multi-species animal activities what he needed for feed. So he balanced all these things in an incredible way, a multifactorial kind of optimization, if you like, but he was doing it all in his head. And as we homogenize the environment and farming, we lose that. We hire a consultant to help us schedule irrigation, tell us when to spray pesticides, which seed to buy, and so on. So we simplify and we give away a lot of the value of our activity and I think a lot of the fun of farming. This whole idea of eco-services is really important. We don't value these things because we don't realize what the rural landscape does for us in terms of mitigating wind, cleaning water, storing water for crops, keeping flows and streams, and of course aesthetics and hunting, fishing, other activities. We undervalue these. About the only one we really recognize is carbon credits, and the way we do that is a little questionable too, because some of our new research is suggesting that the way carbon credits are paid now may not really reflect how much carbon is being sequestered or captured and kept in that spot. So pushing the idea through education about what these eco-services are and how important they are is really important. That's part of this whole package. Just to support some of these ideas, there have been some recent reports. This ISTAD report is a really important one, 800-page report, but you can go into ISTAD and you can find a summary of 80 pages or so, and I guess there are probably even some smaller summaries. But they really push the whole concept of agroecology and looking at natural systems for clues, looking at how we can grow crops in ways that are more sustainable without all the inputs from outside. So that's a really good one. It very clearly, explicitly talks about ecological approaches and agroecology. We were fortunate to get the co-author of this to meet with our students last year, and we will again in about a month and a half over in Norway, Hans Herren. Another one that just came out, I believe, last week, Thursday or so, talked about the evidence of current support for ecological focus, talked about both farming and food systems, which is what we're into in our education. And although they talk about a slight decrease in global food insecurity, there are large populations, something like 1 in 4 people in Africa who are chronically undernourished, and that's something that really is unconscionable in this day and age, in my opinion. So they suggest a need for an ecological approach that's innovative, that looks at food production and availability, because there's plenty of food produced right now. It's a question of access. It's a question of waste. We currently waste around 35, maybe 40% of the food from time of harvest to the time that it's discarded as green stuff out of the refrigerator. Another one that just came out, I guess it was last Wednesday or Thursday, was this Ecumenical Advocacy Alliance, which I didn't know about, although I know that probably 6 or 8 years ago, there was a meeting here in Lincoln, and I think it was Presbyterian, Methodist, and Lutheran, but I'm not sure. They were all looking at sustainability and food production as one of the planks they were going to put in their national conference platform, because churches do this once a year or once every several years, and they were interested. And then this came up just a few days ago, this advocacy alliance, Nourishing the World, Scaling Up Agroecology. Scaling up some of these systems we looked at to a scale that would produce enough food and feed people beyond the farm itself or the immediate local community. So this is what we're doing in education. and I'll shamelessly promote agroecology here and the courses we teach here in Norway and Iowa State, Minnesota, and out in California, everywhere else. It's an approach that looks at practice along with theory and looks at learning theory, how we learn, how we acquire, how we use information, as well as how we plant radishes and other things. One of my Swedish colleagues came up with the term just-in-time learning, which is kind of an industrial cutesy phrase, I guess, but this goes back to Dewey, too. People will acquire things and learn them when they're ready to, when they need them. If things are presented out of context or people don't see the reason to learn something, it's much more difficult. We're doing a lot of work with farmers and with stakeholders in the community, particularly over in Norway, where our student teams go out and spend a week on a farm and in a community learning about what the goals of people are in that place, and then coming up with a series of possible scenarios to help those clients or stakeholders meet their goals. Then they go back and spend another week in the same community, bouncing those ideas off of people, fine-tuning them before they do their final reports. It's working. It's working really well. We're getting people very excited. They're going out, they're going on finishing master's degrees, some going on for PhD, some working in public sector and in universities in various places. And beyond the idea that classes and workshops are for knowledge and skills, we talk about, so what? What are your attitudes toward this situation? What is your goal? What is your worldview? What are you going to use these skills and this new knowledge for? How can we create positive change, what we call responsible action? So we work on these kinds of things in our courses, and it's pretty exciting. We've grown our course here from about a dozen or 15 people back in 98 to 70 last spring, divided in two sections. So agroecology is coming to the fore, and people are recognizing this as something pretty important. To look again at productivity, economic returns, finding systems that are sustainable, and then looking at the social angles rather than saying, well, that's an externality, that doesn't affect me as a plant breeder or an agronomist. I think it's integral. We need to look at the whole system and the people who benefit from that system. Here's some things that are going on in agroecology. The one in Norway, when Barbara and I were there in 98, 99, we did a prototype, and the course has been running since 2000 with 25 students. This year we have 20 students from, I think, 11 different countries. So it's a really rich kind of learning experience with people bringing ideas from a lot of other places in the world. We have a course in the summer with Iowa State, Minnesota, that's been running for about the same length of time. And a spinoff course is going on in Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. One of the faculty people out there came and observed our course and then started up their own. Netherlands at Wageningen has an agroecology master's degree. Witzenhausen is part of the University of Kassel in Germany. They have a master's degree in organic farming. ISARA is a consortium of four private universities in France in agriculture, and they work together with us in a double degree program. A new program started 2 years ago in Alnarp in southern Sweden. They were not able to sell the idea on the main campus in Uppsala, but they were able to do it on a branch campus. And through CEDA, international aid, similar to our USAID in Sweden, there are new programs in Uganda and Ethiopia. And we're currently designing a new PhD program to network all of these groups so that students can take advantage of the people that are around the world in agroecology. And there aren't that many, but the group is growing. So, in conclusion, I think all these three futures are going to be part of what the Great Plains will look like down the road. But I think we need balance, and we also need to move as much as possible toward this ecological model because of fossil fuels. We're over the hill on that one, and we have to look for ways to use water. We're all well convinced of that after the summer. So renewable local inputs. Then biodiversity. Biodiversity is great. Even if you're using chemicals to farm, diversity of chemicals will help you prevent resistance to on the part of weeds or insects. This just came this morning on the internet. Danielle Nirenberg is director of something called Nourishing the Planet Project. She had a whole list of 21 projects that she considered really innovative around the world, and they're just some of the titles of the projects in the U.S., Australia, U.K. So there's a lot going on, really a lot of things that are happening. It's exciting. It's a good time to be in education, a good time to be in agriculture and food, I think, because this is a huge part of the future. So agroecology, building knowledge, skills, attitudes, and then a capacity for looking at the future. One of my favorite quotes is from Joel Barker, who's sort of an interpreter, contemporary interpreter of Thomas Kuhn, who talked about the structure of scientific revolution. And Barker said, action without vision is just passing the time. Vision without action is just a dream. But put them together, action with vision can change the world. So we'll stop with that and have questions. Thank you.